I hope we've all had time to digest the history of science and the importance of peer review, and we're all ready to ask Klaus good questions. But just before I call him back up here, I want to announce that on Monday, this coming Monday, at the university at Andy's place, and I believe there should have been maps about parking passed out to the tables, we're going to have a special session of SACPA on campus. And we have Commander Kelly Larkin from the Canadian frigate HMCS Calgary speaking on the role of Canadian Navy in the Persian Gulf. His boat's actually going there next year. And he's open to any questions you might have to bring him about Canada's role in the military world, about the sovereignty of the Canadian North, and these types of questions. So everybody's encouraged to come over there. It's a beautiful room, and we have the parking arranged for you. As well, on the 29th, next Thursday, we're going to be talking about the impact of currency fluctuations on our economy. Some of you may have noticed that the Canadian dollar is worth more this year than it was at this time last. So that should also be an interesting discussion, perhaps related to the other one or not. Anyway, Klaus, I'll be monitoring the questions. You come to this mic.
Hi, my name is Lorraine McCormick, and we were wondering at our table, what are the chances if you aren't at a university and you don't have a lot of degrees that you could present some of your findings somewhere and have it accredited at all if you are just an ordinary person with no degrees? And how would you find out where you could submit your findings? And is there a chance that since you don't have any any degrees or anything, that it might be repressed because you don't have any background?
Yeah, that's a very easy question to answer because, as I told you, anybody can do science. You don't need a master's, you don't need a PhD. You just have to be a good observer, good data collector, good analysis of data, and good communicator. You make your submission, whatever your subject matter may be, to the appropriate journal. Now, if you think you have a really hot potato here, you will try to go for a really reputable high-class journal because they are not all high-class because all sorts of information should be published, but it doesn't all have room in the top-level journal. So you go down a level and you find the appropriate journal of subject matter and circulation and so on, and you submit it there, and you hope it will be accepted after peer review. And it doesn't matter what your name is, where you live, what your color of skin is, it doesn't matter what your religion is. That's the only thing is the truth.
My name is Van Christou. Thank you very much, Klaus, for coming this morning and or this afternoon and presenting a very large subject so adequately and so clearly, as big a subject as science. You mentioned, Klaus, the fact that science has been so exciting, is so exciting, and is also so competitive. It seems to me that if our ability to, as human beings, to become more civilized rather than more intelligent or more well-informed, if that ability to become civilized is outpaced by our ability to control nature through scientific process, then is not science having a disastrous and cumulative effect on both humanity and on our Mother Earth? Would you like to address that?
Yeah, he's always very friendly when he asks you the question, and then the bullet comes. But you see, this is exactly the very nucleus of why this subject is so important to be communicated to the public, and we're not doing a good enough job. Because science is indeed racing away with seeking information and leaving the public behind. We have huge issues to deal with socially and environmentally. And we will only address them properly and urgently if the public, if democracy is intact and comes along with the process. It's the last proverb on the sheet I gave you is very relevant to this. It's democracy. The survival of democracy is extremely important that we keep up with the pace of scientific information, because a lot of the scientific information is coming from defense budget-supported grants and so on, and they're pushing it as hard as they can to get their military advantages and so on. So we have to keep science and its results in the public hands. Van, am I answering your question?
I see.
Does it help us to understand the world around us and therefore react with it and with each other more civilized, more compassionately, and so on? Is that getting close to what you're asking? Exactly. Yes. Exactly. And yeah. No, this is very true. In that sense, because as you say, the scientific process is so narrow focused, it has to be, in order to come to a definitive answer, you have to be narrowly focused. And the people who summarize scientific information are very few who are capable of doing it. It is a very difficult thing to do and a brave thing to do, because you're knocking a lot of edges and so on. I mean, I'm thinking of Richard Dawkins now, his magnificent book of 30 years ago, The Selfish Gene. I mean, it just rocked society and as to who we are and how we fit in the world and so on, you know. So that is a type of communication we need. And it is, as was said, it's a narrative, the communication to the public, that is so important to bring it down to the level so that the public can understand it and then act on it, hopefully. You're quite right. The direct application of this massive scientific avalanche that's coming at us to behave more civilized, more socially, I don't think it's there. In fact, it's fearful as it sounds, I think it's almost not there at all. Yeah. No, that's it. I'm glad this came out, Van. So the next question is, what process do we need to address just that? You know, to talk to each other and behave with each other in a more humane and civilized way. And I'm not sure if the scientific process can help us. Yeah. In fact, I doubt if it can. That's a horrible question, Van.
Hi, Klaus. Henning Mundel is my name. And having just recently retired after 4 decades as a plant breeder, I came up with a little definition for what plant breeding is all about, and that may have some relevance to a lot of the processes in the history of science that you outlined and some of the concerns that Van addressed by these few words that, in fact, in science, I talked about it in terms of in plant breeding, developing variety. A lot of it is optimizing serendipity. In other words, it's not just the data. It's not just the analysis of that. And suddenly you see something off at tangent, and you are able to see it. You're able to integrate. And so that ultimately in science we need to rely a lot on optimizing serendipity. But I have two questions which have nothing to do with that. You mentioned the data collection and analysis and so on. To me, that looks, you'd left out that whole area. You emphasized the empirical, quantitative aspect, but what about the qualitative aspects in terms of science? So that's sort of one question. And the other question is, you talked about that basically we don't make money on it. Well, even Einstein was a patent clerk, but a lot of patents, a lot of private sector money, which want to control the message, what gets out and when it gets out, does that hinder science?
Henning, you're not a nice guy either, are you? But let me do the last one first. You're quite right. And I said ideal, the ideal scientist, the ideal situation. And, of course, they're all humans, and we all humans, we just destroy the ideal wherever we can. It's just horrible how we make a mess of things because of this competition. And that is a danger of science. Science is based on liberal, free communication of information. And that is now being compromised, definitely. You have a good idea, or you want to make a buck, or the grant maker who gives you the money wants to make a buck. Therefore, you're going to put it into a patent form. Therefore, it will not be published tomorrow or the week after. So, and also, you go to meetings, and communication between scientists is not what it used to be. I will only give you as much as I dare to give you because my livelihood is dependent on this, and you're not going to beat me at this. And so, this humanity is a integral part of the nowadays process of science. There's this competition for grants and so on. You want to be first to get that grant, and so it's a very cutthroat business. So the liberal exchange of information is being compromised at this present time. Very, very unfortunate. Very bad for science. Very bad for society. You had another question about quality. You mean quality of work? Or the quality of information, of data. Qualitative in the performance of your work, you mean the quality of your work versus the quality of some other endeavor? Is that what you're saying?
My name is Don Ferguson. Thank you, Dr. Jericho, for your thoughts on science.
I don't like this Dr. Jericho. He's got something up his sleeve.
You can relax now because I don't have a difficult question like the two forerunners. I'm wondering about how convincing you've been in terms of this group or television audience in terms of believing in science or not believing in it. And one of the journals you mentioned, Nature, was an article published in May 2007 which dealt with the topic, What Americans Believe, and I'd like to refresh your memory. So this is from a Gallup poll. The initial results relate to the poll that was done in either late 2006 or 2007, and the last item goes back to 1994. 12% believe that life on Earth has evolved through a natural process without the interference of a deity. 53% believe in creationism, which proclaims that the universe was created 6,000 years ago. 44% believe that Jesus will return in the next 50 years to judge the living and the dead. Now, in 1994, 46% preferred creationism to evolution, hence the creationist creed is in fact advancing. So my question to you is, would you care to comment on why the televangelists, the Jimmy Swaggerts of the world, persons who hold a dramatically non-scientific approach to reality, or more effective in propagating their propaganda and nonsense than scientists are in communicating science in a convincing manner, at least in the United States of America?
This is one of my best friends. I have coffee with him all the time. Dr. Ferguson, shame on you. Of course, as someone who seeks the truth, I spend quite a bit of time, and it's all, as everybody, everybody does this, you try to figure out how things hang together. But your question hinges on belief. And belief, this is my totally personal assessment of the situation, is a totally personalized thing. And faith and belief are in one corner of the ring, and science and the seeking of the truth are in another corner of the ring. They must, in fact, hopefully, they're not even in the same ring. They should be in separate rings and have just leave them alone, because you need science and information, and you need faith and belief in the other. Humans are just made that way, and unless somebody comes up with a design of humans, I think it's best to leave them separate. I really can't answer your question any better than that. I don't believe in mixing them up.
Dr. Jericho, I'd like to hear you expand on something that I've encountered in my life. And I'm referring to scientific meetings. You didn't say you've talked a lot about journals, but every science group has annual meetings in which scientists stand at a podium, and the room is full of their experts. So the way an idea is tested is against that audience. I've been to a lot of those meetings when I was in Milwaukee and Minneapolis and Washington, including the AAAS, the American Association of, Advancement of Science, in which there were thousands of scientists. And in every case, I think, and I'd like to hear you expand on that, I defend what you're saying by saying that a man may stand there and give a paper that a woman out there talked about it last year, and her research came quite a ways into the frontiers, but he's found something additional. People say, well, scientists don't agree with each other. So you're saying something that improved what she said last year, and she thanks you for it. That's the way science moves. That's not scientists disagreeing with scientists. Isn't that one of the best examples to show the average audience that different views on science are fully debated, especially in scientific meetings, not just journals. We have, on North America, we have thousands of different scientific meetings once a year.
Howard, I think a wonderful point you made, and I think you answered the question yourself. That is the nature of the process, the ideal scientific process, where everybody joins hands and to find out and make progress. And you know, when you come up with a paper, you know it will be refuted, or corners will be shaven off it, and it will be improved the next time. Or you might even improve it yourself the next time. And you communicate with others, and they say, I found this and so on. That's what it's all about, and that's why you go to meetings. I mean, Vic Gannon the other day, he came back from the North American microbiology meeting in Toronto, and I asked him, well, how many people were there? 5,000, 600? He says, well, tied 25,000. I mean, these are huge meetings. I mean, you know, and this is just one of them. And all these people are flying all over the place, and these meetings, these conventions, are just, that's why I say this thing is huge. It is huge. And it is part of this communication thing. And there are so many lectures at these meetings. You can't attend them all. You have to really specify which one you will attend. And on top of that, you walk along the halls. You have left and right, have all these posters, which are sort of summaries of papers on a sheet of paper about 5 by 5 feet, which you sort of can see is sort of standing at some distance. And there are thousands of those. So the information flow is just incredible. And this reminds me that I forgot that in my talk. When I took genetics at the veterinary school in Guelph in 1960, the book was about this big. That was just 7 years after the nucleic acid code, which you have on your paper, was identified. Well, I audited a course in genetics last year at the university, and that's the book now, and in thickness. And this is 5 years out of date, so the next one is going to be much thicker yet. So you have some idea at the expansion of information that's taking place. It's just unbelievable. And I don't know if we humans will actually have enough brain capacity to handle all this. And this relates to Van, as to how to digest this all and funnel it in the direction we want it to go.
I'm Trevor Page. Klaus, thank you for your presentation. Notwithstanding your response to the question before last, there was quite a bit of interest at our table in what we think we have you correctly quoted in your presentation when you said that elements of our body have been found out there in the universe. And we'd like we'd like you to elaborate on that, and we're looking for scientific information. Thank you.
I'm not the right person to answer that, but I took an astronomy course at the university also. I'm retired now. I have time for this, you see. And when you're 65 years and older, you can just walk into this class and say to the professor, do you mind if I listen in? And he says, okay, there you sit in and you listen to all these lectures. It's wonderful. But I did that with astronomy, and I read the astronomy book, which is that thick, the universe. And I learned in one of those pages, my goodness gracious, there are these supernovas, these stars which are exploding out there, and they're producing oxygen and carbon and nitrogen, all these things, and gold and all these things. And that's how these elements, which we find on Earth and which we are therefore part of, came to be where they are now. So it is indeed one universe. We are nothing special. We're nothing out of the ordinary. It all makes very good sense that it all hangs together as one happy family.
Klaus, Terry Shillington, thank you for your presentation and for your passion for science and for truth. I'm intrigued by your comments about creationism and your response to Don Ferguson's question. And I don't understand the first chapters of the Bible as being a scientific manual, but more of a faith statement. And so I think you bring science and you bring science to your reading of the book of Genesis. So I'm wondering what you meant when you said that we'll keep creationism over there and we'll keep science over here, and because we live in a world in which creationists are insisting that their version of the origins of the earth belong in the same classroom with scientific theories about that are validated by some research and so on. So could you say more about where you see how you see creationism in the same school curriculum as the theory of evolution, for example?
I hope we wouldn't get into this subject. Because the concept of creationism is not innately comfortable for me, you know. The information on evolution is so overwhelmingly true. Thank you, Eric. It is so much evidence. That's the big word. There's so much evidence for it that I can't even bother being exposed to the alternate story. But I respect other people having it. They obviously find it more comfortable and enjoy life more the other way. And I'm not going to refute them. That's wonderful. Because eventually, with given enough time, the truth has a tendency to percolate to the top. You know, it may take a long time, but there are so many human realities of belief and makeup and so on, which will make this percolation process, maybe in this particular case, very slow, very slow. There's nothing we can do about it. It's all about fear and how we make the world around us less fearful. And that's really what science attempted to do. The technology that came out of this to make life more comfortable, it was miserable. And of course, unfortunately, in many parts of the world, it's still miserable. But by golly, nobody's suffering in this room here right today. And that's all due to science and technology. Did I answer your question, Terry?
My name is Brooke Cully. Thanks for your presentation. And just on that note, I ran for school board this past election, and the first six emails I got were what I thought of creationism and whether it should be taught in science class or not. So it was really a hard campaign to run because of that single question. But my question is about the corporatization of science. And you talked about science and technology working hand in hand, but if I'm a scientist working in science and I'm thwarted by my attempts to advance science because the technology is owned by somebody else, have we already passed the corner where science in the public sphere doesn't happen? And I wanted to know about your feelings about our government, our federal government, science and technology proposal, the way they're going forward with our science technology. The lead ministry on that is industry. And is that necessarily the right ministry to be advancing science in?
Yeah, I think you answered your own questions too. I think it's very, very, very true what you say, that this is, again, part of this handicapped communication that is taking place in science. Money is, as I told you, these studies are really expensive now. And I guess the public purses are not big enough to handle all of them. And then, of course, industry who have got special interests and say, well, I give you money, get going and study this. And, of course, when you're going to, if the money comes from there, and hopefully the next grant money will also come from there, then you will behave accordingly. Of course you will. You will be very careful as to what you say and how you interpret it and so on. It is just human survival. Very unfortunate, very bad for science. Very unfortunate. So the corporations, yeah, but you see, they rely on us to buy their stuff. So if we ask the right questions and if we collectively can listen to the right answers, well, maybe we won't buy some of their stuff and then they will behave. But I don't know if it works. Reality doesn't work that way. Yeah. And at the schools, yeah, I think it would be most unfortunate if creationism is taught at schools instead of evolution. I think that would be very unfortunate.
My name is Mildred Mayberry, and thank you very much for coming to us. And you've certainly fielded questions from many different areas of interest. But the one that I want to ask you about is, if science is pure, and you have really people who are really longing to seek the truth about certain things, I have to go along with Van, who says the society isn't ready for it. I just think of treatment for illnesses. We have more every 3 months. You go and a new medication has been discovered for the particular condition you have. And there's nothing seems to be being spent on research about prevention. There has to be prevention. The condition I'm suffering from apparently has doubled in the last 5 years. Now, that is a very obvious thing. Now, whether the information, that information was scientific, I don't know. What I do know is there's a lot more talk about cures with pharmaceutical companies financing the research for it than there is about prevention. Which gets back to my position, my field, is we have to keep this medication public, where the whole society is paying for the cost of research, and the research might more likely be in prevention than if we leave it to the pharmaceutical companies.
I agree with you. That's really all I can say. This is the unfortunate situation we are in right now. These huge companies, I mean, that's how they survive, and we get more and more products out there. Well, not only in the pharmacies. You go to Canadian Tires, everybody is trying to sell you something, and we are gullible, and we pick this up, and the information is not right. We still pick it up and say, well, maybe this will be fun, or maybe this will help me, and on and on. And there's so many of us, and if they just sell one of those things, then I made profit. So it's just a horrible economic system out there, which we hope we don't combine with the process of science. Do you know what I mean? But we are. It's getting mixed up, and we people have to prevent that mixing. That's the point. And Van says, good luck.
Bev Lindell-Atherstone. Thank you, Klaus. For those who are curious about the fact that we are all star men and star women, the Lethbridge Astronomy Society that Klaus and I both belong to has open house sessions every last Saturday in the month at 7:30 down in Popson Park. Our table, which had many questioners, really talked a lot about boundaries. And I think Millie, our last questioner, talked a lot about the boundaries, too, of science and how it can be really pulled to an extreme, as with the pharmaceutical companies who make drugs for their own benefit. My question is, well, first I want to say that my concern is that science is based within a very Eurocentric viewpoint and a very Eurocentric tradition
with European languages. Thus, it already is minimal in terms of looking at a whole world. It has a particular worldview, irrespective of the fact that science is done in many countries now. It still has a particular worldview. It looks at things in a very particular manner. And yet, we look to science to solve all of our major problems of the day. And our major problems seem to be problems with belief, as in belief in creationism. Our problems are belief problems with social services, housing for the poor, our values, and our ethics. And yet we constantly look to science and ask for researchers to give us reasons why we should help the poor, why we should build houses. How will it benefit our society financially to take people off the street and give them homes? Now, it seems to me, and here's my question, hasn't science really become our new ism, our new belief, our new faith that we want to solve all of the problems of our day in Western societies? Hasn't it outreached its actual basis?
Poor Klaus. Has it outreached? Yeah, this relates to Van's question. Does science actually address many of the social issues we need to address? Is that more or less what you were asking? Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, social issues are very difficult for science to address. They're very, very difficult for science to address. You need huge numbers and pollings and so on, and this is probably one of the reasons. The one area where science is difficult to apply. It's very difficult to apply. I don't think I can answer. I just cannot answer your question. Science is very good at specific issues, specific, and then teasing it apart, and then hopefully eventually coming up with a whole. But human behavior and human qualitative assessments and so on, science doesn't address value issues. Science does not address value issues. I'm glad I remembered that. It addresses quantitative issues and things which can be put into numbers and so on. But value issues, science is not designed to solve.